Support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, coffee, extra virgin olive oil, and featuring a selection of new cheeses every week. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in this hour of the show, we have a health topic for you. Throughout the year, we have physicians on the program to answer questions. We have people who are either generalists, like our family practice doctor, and we also have a OBGYN pediatrician. But occasionally, we do have people on the program who specialize in some particular area, and that is the case this morning. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent from Christie Clinic. She is a gastroenterologist, so she specializes in the digestive tract and all the things that can cause problems there, things like reflux and heartburn and irritable bowel and all of those sorts of things that are often complaints and things that people have difficulty with. So what we'll do this morning, as we usually do, is to try to talk about some basic things and see if we can add to your store of health information. And of course, your questions are welcome. The only thing that I try to impress on people right at the beginning when we have a doctor on the show is that obviously because the doctor can't see you, well, we can't do diagnosis over the telephone. There are limits to what we can do. But I don't want to discourage anyone from calling. If you have a question, this might be a place to start and get some basic information. And, of course, then if you have concerns, you need to take them up with a doctor who can see you. Questions are certainly welcome, though. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
I appreciate it. I thought maybe just to pick a topic to start with, we might talk a little bit about heartburn and reflux disease, because it seems that there's a lot of it out there. We seem to see more and more people who are taking medication for it. They're very frequently prescribed medications, and just not very long ago, the one that had been available only by prescription, Prilosec, went over the counter. And I understand now that there's so much demand for that the company who makes it cannot hardly keep up. They can't hardly make enough because it's been very heavily advertised, and people seem to think they have the problem, so they're going out and taking medication. First of all, I'm sure if we go out on the street and we ask people, "Have you ever had heartburn?" we'd get an awful lot of people who saying that they had. So. If we could look at what was going on inside the person at that point where they were reporting that burning sensation, what is happening? What is heartburn?
Heartburn is actually when acid is coming up from the stomach and into the esophagus. The esophagus is not equipped to handle beyond a certain amount of acid, and so if there's repeated insults, eventually it will either cause symptoms and/or it will actually cause ulcerations or breakdown of the lining of the esophagus. So when people say they have heartburn, you just think that there's acid coming up and, I guess, challenging that lining.
Hmm. So that's what happens. When people feel that burning, that's because there is acid from the stomach, and the stomach's made to hold it, but the esophagus isn't. So when you get it up there, obviously you're going to feel something.
Exactly.
That feeling. So what happens when we go from what is kind of garden variety heartburn that people occasionally have to what we would diagnose, what you would diagnose as reflux disease?
Well, they can be one and the same, but beyond a certain point, and it's actually usually based on the symptomatology of the patient. If it's a frequent recurring problem, then beyond just using medicine on occasion, there's something. There are some patients that have significant problems with repeated challenges of the acid that they need to be on medicines chronically to control the symptoms and also control any damage that might be occurring secondarily.
Mm-hmm. I know that if you go in and you start talking about this with your doctor, the first sorts of things that they're going to say is, well, there are certain things that you can do in terms of your diet, your lifestyle, that can help perhaps before you do anything else. You may want to use some medications that will lower your acid production, but there are other things that you can do that anybody can do right to start out. And they say, is there certain things we want you to avoid
Yes. And just for garden variety reflux problems, which are very, very common, and almost, I think, almost everyone has a little bit of that, you can take antacids over the counter that will give more of immediate relief. There are certain foods that actually lower the pressures in the esophageal muscle, in the lower muscle, that's supposed to help keep acid from coming up. Those foods are, there's a chemical in tomatoes that does this. Mint is a very strong relaxant of that, which is why sometimes mint also helps for just stomach upset in general, because it relaxes intestinal movement. And caffeine. So those are probably the three main foods that actually relax that muscle and then increase the potential for acid coming up. Acid-containing foods don't necessarily do that, such as orange juice or citrus juices or grapefruit juice. But if you're already irritated, they certainly will burn going down.
Mm-hmm. Also, there seems to be some relationship between an individual's weight and the tendency to reflux.
Exactly. Being overweight, obesity is obviously a major problem in the United States. Everyone's heard about that. And the increased pressures, abdominal pressures, just put more pressure on that muscle in the lower esophagus to the point that it just can't, it's just not strong enough to keep up with those type of pressures from the obesity itself.
So if we ask the question, well, why is it that we seem to be seeing more reflux, do you think that you can account for that with this combination of lifestyle factors, what people are eating, and the fact that there are a fair number of people that are probably above their ideal weight?
Oh, certainly. I think there's probably a very good correlation. The other things that also increase reflux are if the stomach empties more slowly, then you have more pressures in the stomach to potentially increase the reflux into the esophagus, and things like fat. So fast foods, which are high in fat, will empty much more slowly out of the stomach, and so that's a potential problem. We're a fast food society.
What's the thought now about if someone is taking chronically acid-reducing medications, how long you can keep on doing that?
Well, you can take them forever. There were some concerns to begin with, especially with medicines like Zantac or Tagamet, which were the first medicines we really had that created a decrease in acid production over than just maybe a half an hour, just like the antacids do, that you had to give a rest and get off those medicines. But that's not really been proven. And over time, as they've been used more chronically, we know that they're safe. The same is true of Prilosec. When that was first released, it was released for use for 2 months at a time by FDA approval. And there was concerns that there might be very rare stomach tumors that could become a problem if it was used more chronically. That was seen in the rats that was tested on to begin with. It was not seen in other species of animals that were tested, and it has not been seen in humans.
Okay. Well, our guest, as I said, in this hour, Focus 580, is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist. We're talking about digestive health, and if you have questions, I know she'll do her best to give you an answer. We have several people here ready to go, and we'll take them in the order they came in and start with line one, the callers in Champaign. Hello. Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Dr. Nugent, I would like for you to talk about various testing. Could you tell me exactly if a CAT scan would show a liver blockage or kidney impairment, and whether that would be a better choice than like an MRI? What kind of testing should one kind of look into if there's a possible liver problem and kidney problem? And also, if you have any experience with candidiasis within the digestive tract, and what kind of testing to try to find out if candidiasis is actually there.
Okay. The first question, what type of test to look for kidney or liver problems? It depends really on what you're looking for. Tests all have their strengths and weaknesses in different situations. So if you're looking for stones in the kidney, for example, a CAT scan usually is a pretty good test. There may be better tests for looking at the drainage from the kidney and looking for stones there. If you're looking at for cancer, for example, in a kidney, then a CAT scan would be a great test. If you're trying to tell the difference between a cyst or a solid lesion, or cancer in either the kidney or the liver, an ultrasound actually is sometimes better because it can tell the difference between fluid and solid densities, sometimes better than a CAT scan can. If you're looking at the texture of both those organs, then sometimes a CAT scan can be a little bit more informative. MRI scans are sometimes very useful for distinguishing types of lesion, whether they are benign blood vessels such as hemangiomas. Then an MRI image is actually sometimes better than a CAT scan. CAT scans have really developed quite a lot in the last 5 years, so that the quality of images we're getting with CAT scan, because of how they're being done, is actually approaching some of the information that previously we had gotten on MRI imaging. Again, so it depends on what you're looking for. MRIs are sometimes more useful than in looking actually at the ductal network in the liver and the pancreas, so that can be done, and whereas a CAT scan cannot tell quite the same detail. So it really would depend on what you're looking for as to the best test to look at those things. As far as the second question of candidiasis, which is yeast in the GI tract, yeast is actually a normal flora, normal component in the colon. And we actually sometimes will give yeast tablets for trying to have patients get their normal bacterial and yeast flora back in their colon to avoid diarrhea problems, or help them, after, for example, after antibiotic therapy, which can sometimes kill off the normal bacteria and organisms in the colon. Otherwise, yeast is not something that you want to see for the most part, and certainly in the mouth it causes thrush. You see that sometimes in babies or even adult patients after they take an antibiotic therapy. Diabetic patients are a little bit more prone to that. Yeast in the esophagus, candidal esophagitis, is quite a problem that is seen also sometimes in diabetics, people that don't clear their esophagus normally for movement problems within the esophagus, and that certainly is an infection, usually very treatable with certain medicines.
All right. Is the caller still there? Have we gotten to your question?
I was really thinking more in terms of candida that's gotten out of control and called candidiasis, where it actually invades the intestinal tract or may even invade some of the internal organs. Are you familiar with anything like that?
The most common thing that we see in GI with candidiasis is the infection in the esophagus. So candidal esophagitis is what's that called. Once you have yeast that actually infects the body, gets into the bloodstream and localizes in other organs, that's almost always seen in, for example, in patients with AIDS or HIV, where very immunocompromised patients where the immune system is just not up to snuff to fighting that back, because otherwise that doesn't happen. It's sometimes seen in intensive care unit patients that are very, very sick, that have been on antibiotics for a long time, and they're finally, their own immune system cannot fight the yeast, and it can then invade. But that's a much more unusual circumstance.
Okay. Again, I have some other callers, but I just want to make sure that we've tried to answer your question.
I just wondered if there was any kind of test to see if internal organs have candida infection.
If the esophagus is involved, that usually requires an endoscopy and biopsy. For organs and systemic infection, usually it's simply testing the blood culture for growth of those organisms is enough in that situation. Otherwise, there's no specific tests that I'm aware of to look, for example, liver involvement, et cetera. Usually that will be in the bloodstream as well, and a blood test, a blood culture for specifically for yeast would be informative and would give you the information you need to have.
Right. Well, I hope that helps. We have some other callers here. I would like to go on to someone else here in Champaign. This will be line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about a relatively non-invasive diagnostic procedure which involves sliding a scope, I guess it's through the mouth or through the nose, down to look at an inflamed pancreatic duct, and this would have been following a narrow slice CT scan that this was recommended. And I was wondering if you could please discuss the procedure and the advantages and the risks, how to choose a physician to do this, and if you could think of any alternatives or procedures that could be done prior to this, which sounds pretty hairy. Thank you very much.
Okay.
The procedure I think that you're referring to is called an ERCP, and that stands for endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography, which is why we call it ERCP. It's a lot easier to say. That is an endoscopic procedure where patients are sedated. The scope, which is, I have a very small index finger. It's about the size of my index finger, and that's put down. It's flexible. The opening to the pancreas and the bile duct are both in the first part of the small intestine. So you go down and find that, insert a small tube, and then inject dye. And that probably gives us the most accurate way at looking at both the bile duct and the pancreatic duct for both narrowing of those ducts, looking for stones, for example, in the bile duct. Could be gallstones that get into there, or any narrowing in the bile ducts or any dilation of those ducts. The procedure is painless. Patients are sedated. Certainly it's a little bit gaggy to have a scope down there. It lasts on average between a half an hour to 1 hour. The strengths of that procedure are that you can get biopsies and brushings if you need to check for cancer. The downside is, unfortunately, doing biopsies and brushings that way has about a 40 to 50% accuracy rate. So if it's positive for a cancer, then you're right on the money. That's very reliable. However, if it's negative, you may miss lesions 50 to 60% of the time. And that's often because the lesion itself will be around the duct rather than inside the duct and pressing in. So there's a little bit of an accuracy problem there. The procedure does have some risks. Anytime we do endoscopy, we always say there's a potential for side effects to the medicines. That's unusual because patients are monitored pretty carefully. There's a low risk of poking holes through things. Again, that's unlikely. As long as people are experienced. Probably the major risk with an ERCP is that any type of manipulation of the opening to the pancreatic duct and then certainly injection of dye or any other tubes into the pancreatic duct increases the risk of pancreatitis developing. And that risk is about 3.5 to 5% as quoted by most studies. It seems to be a little bit less the less that you have to actually do. So if you've got a procedure that's less complicated, they're not challenging the pancreas quite as much, and certainly if it's a procedure that's done by someone more experienced and therefore a little bit easier to do, that risk seems to go down, but most people still quote about a 3.5% risk of that developing. That's usually a mild problem, maybe some abdominal pain, nausea and vomiting for a few days, less than a week. There is no treatment, unfortunately, for pancreatitis, so you have to let it go away on its own and let the pancreas rest by not feeding patients. It can be life-threatening, but that's extremely rare. But certainly it's part of the risks that we quote patients before we do the procedure. The alternatives for ERCP include an MRI-type scan called an MRCP that has a fairly good accuracy rate as far as looking for narrowings, looking for stones, also looking for masses in both pancreas and the liver. The downside is that you can't do biopsies or do any therapy. So if you have some obstruction of a duct, the MRC can give you a diagnosis, but it can't then put a tube in to help drain it. The MRCP can also not be used in patients that have had pacemakers, have had recent surgery, or have any other metal artifacts such as a joint replacement. And so that's just not an option for patients in those situations.
Also, the caller had the question about supposing that you're going to have one of these procedures or maybe you're going to have an endoscopy and you are thinking about how do you find somebody to do this. I would guess that one of the things that you would want to know is how many of these have you done, and you'd like to have the person that has the more experience doing that. Is that something that assuming that you actually have a choice of physicians, is that something that's you can actually find out?
Yeah, you just ask the doctor.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's a very good question. And we know that the complications are decreased with the number of procedures that you do and the more experience that you get. So certainly people that do one or two of these a year are going to have more problems than people that do, you know, two or three a week.
Yeah.
Or more.
Do most gastroenterologists do them, or is it something of a specialty?
It's a little bit more of a specialty. During the time of my training, I think most people got at least the basic ERCP training. at least for diagnostic. With a therapeutic, you had to do a little bit more specialty training. Since then, I think a lot of programs have made that more of a specialized training, or adding an extra year or 6 months to your training in order to get that, where it's not just a basic gastroenterology training anymore.
We have other callers. I hope that helps. Let's go to line number one, I believe. No, first, line number three next. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to acid reflux and, well, what my mom and I call tiny bubbles, which I think is what you're referring to as acid reflux. And she's 90 years old, and the last time she saw a doctor, who we're not going to see again, he said that once you have an ulcer, which she had some slight kind of ulcer apparently after taking Vioxx about 10 years ago for arthritis, then you have to keep taking Prilosec. I guess I was just trying to say, what is she taking the Prilosec for? Is it for the hiatal hernia that's the size of Texas, or because she gets these tiny bubbles, which in reaction to certain foods that she might eat, she might start like kind of throwing up tiny bubbles after eating dry white chicken or something like that? So I guess I'm just kind of curious about Vioxx and Celebrex and Prilosec and Prilosec and hiatal hernias. She stopped taking Celebrex after having heart failure and pneumonia, and then followed by C. diff this spring. And she, after 40 years of having arthritis, she's taking Tylenol for her arthritis. So I'm just curious, you know, when you look at the package, it says it's for heartburn, but it seems that people use it for a lot of different things.
Okay, that's a loaded question. Let me see the best I can do with it. Let me first start with talking about Vioxx and Celebrex and those types of medicines.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of medicines that are available called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that are most useful for arthritis-type problems. They usually work great. The downside is that there's a potential ulcer risk with those, and usually it's either in the stomach or the duodenum. Although if those medicines lodge in the esophagus, they can actually burn an ulcer right there. But usually esophageal ulcers are less related to those types of medicines, unless it's a direct contact effect. Vioxx and Celebrex, and I believe Bextra is the other one that's currently available. There may be more now, but I think those are the three first ones that came out, are called COX-2 inhibitors, and they are supposed to be less damaging to the GI tract and as effective as the traditional nonsteroidals such as naproxen, ibuprofen, etc. were. They have turned out not to be quite as safe on the GI tract as originally was thought, and so we are seeing some GI side effects to those medicines, although not quite as frequently as we did with things like ibuprofen and naproxen. All right, so that's number one. Number two, if you have a hiatal hernia the size of Texas, to quote you, which is a great description, I think I'll use that in the future. Thanks.
Yeah.
That a hiatal hernia is where the stomach has protruded up through the opening in the diaphragm, where the esophagus is supposed to come through, and the stomach is supposed to be below the level of the diaphragm. So if the stomach comes up, that's called a hiatal hernia. And hiatal hernias are very common, especially small ones that will kind of slide back and forth. Large ones like that are a little bit less common, but they significantly increase the risk and damage potential from reflux disease, because now you don't have the protective effect of the diaphragm holding acid down. You've got a bunch of acid already up in the stomach. It's already above the level of the diaphragm, and so one of your protective mechanisms for keeping that from coming up into the esophagus is gone. In that situation, the potential then for reflux and secondary problems, which it sounds like your mother or grandmother is experiencing, certainly is fairly high. And I wouldn't be surprised if someone had recommended that she go on something like Prilosec and just use it forever,
right,
so as to decrease the potential for any problems.
Okay, well, then you've clarified to me, because I keep thinking she has an esophageal ulcer or acid reflux and they're giving her Prilosec, but then my thinking is that she's getting the Prilosec for the hiatal hernia. Now I see the relationship between the acid reflux, any kind of esophageal problem,
right,
and the high. Okay, so what about something like Fosamax? Is that in the same category as Vioxx and Celebrex?
No, not at all. Fosamax is a medicine that's used to prevent and hopefully reverse osteoporosis.
Exactly.
Fosamax does not have the same effect on the GI tract as far as breaking down the lining in the GI tract. However, Fosamax is one of the medicines that if it comes into contact in your esophagus and sticks, it can easily burn an ulcer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the recommendations for taking that medicine are to drink lots of water afterwards to make sure it gets washed down. So the effect of Fosamax is very different as far as potential ulcer problems than Vioxx or Celebrex. And Fosamax is not known for causing ulcer problems in the stomach itself, but more just in the esophagus if it sticks.
So if you had an esophageal problem, you might consider not taking Fosamax?
Yeah, if your esophagus doesn't move normally, and there is something called presbyesophagus, which means old esophagus, so we see this in old people, where the movement is just not normal, and so things tend not to go down as easily, and that then has to be considered if you're going to be using the Fosamax as a potential problem.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You've clarified
a lot
of things.
Just to follow, real quick again to follow up on that, there are a couple of other popular medicines that are like Fosamax that are that I assume would be chemically related, or at least they're supposed to do the same thing. They're all treatments for osteoporosis. You hope that will prevent osteoporosis. Do they also have the same kind of side effects that you see with the Fosamax?
Depends on which medicines you're talking about. I'm not as well-versed in all the anti-osteoporosis medicines, but I believe there's one called Actonel that also has the same potential risks. There's a myocalcin nasal spray that is used that has absolutely no effect on the GI tract, nor on the nasal tract. So that certainly doesn't have any risk for problems like that.
Okay. We're already at our midpoint here. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist from Christie Clinic, and we're talking about digestive health issues. And if you have questions, she will see if she can help you out. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Back here to a caller on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes. I have an ongoing hacking cough, as well as I've had it for several years, off and on. And at one point, I believe it was a doctor's assistant suggested that it could be related to acid reflux. And I also have a kind of a pain that I sometimes have that is kind of similar to an acid reflux. I would think that's about 3.5 inches to the left of my solar plexus. And I was wondering whether, number one, whether those are related, and whether they're related to acid reflux.
Well, sure, possibly. First of all, to address the cough issue,
mm-hmm.
Reflux is known to potentially exacerbate asthma problems, and often patients that have chronic cough problems may have some mild asthma.
Uh-huh.
It's a great idea, and has actually been promoted by a lot of studies, to simply place patients on acid-controlling medicine, such as Prilosec, for a few months' time at fairly high doses.
Mm-hmm.
Suppress the acid and see if your cough gets better. That's a very easy test to do.
Right.
The medicine's usually very well tolerated, and if your cough significantly improves, then certainly that would suggest that, yeah, the reflux is a potential exacerbator.
Mm-hmm.
There are other tests that are a little bit more invasive to see if there's a significant reflux component. One of those is called a pH monitor. The test involves putting a small tube down your nose, leaving it in the lower part of the esophagus for 24 hours, and the probe end actually measures the acid that is coming up into the esophagus. Small amounts of acid are normal, but beyond a certain point, then it becomes abnormal. And that test will tell us how much acid reflux does occur in 24 hours, and it also tells us if there's any correlation between a cough episode and a significant reflux episode. So it's not fun to have a tube in your nose. Personally, I think I would opt for taking Prilosec for a few months to see if it got better.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All certainly. Right, thank you. On to another caller. This is also Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I was calling because I heard the doctor say that peppermint and tomatoes are good to control acid reflux, but I didn't hear what you said about caffeine and because my phone rang. So if you could repeat that, and specifically coffee, is that bad for, does that exacerbate an acid reflux?
Okay, let me correct you first. Peppermint and tomatoes and caffeine make reflux potentially worse.
Oh, worse.
Right. Peppermint, however, has been promoted for just general stomach upset because it does relax movement of the intestines and stomach sometimes. So I think a lot of people will actually take mint and it soothes their stomach, but it potentially could exacerbate their reflux problems.
Okay. And orange juice, did you say the same?
Orange juice doesn't so much. the problem with peppermint, tomatoes, and caffeine is that they all have chemicals that actually relax the lower esophageal sphincter, the muscle that helps keep acid from coming out of the esophagus. Whereas, now I forget exactly what you had asked about.
She was asking about orange juice.
Orange juice, I'm sorry, thank you. Acid juices don't do that. However, if you're already irritated, they're going to burn because they're just acid on a wound type thing.
Okay. Are there any foods that would do the opposite then that would be good for somebody with acid reflux?
Not that we're aware of.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can't, there are things that you, it's good to avoid, but there's nothing that works the other way that seems to make it
exactly
better.
Exactly.
What about alcohol? Because that's often one of the things, when people have a problem with reflux, it is recommended that people limit, if not completely eliminate, having any alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol does probably relax the esophageal sphincter somewhat, although it's not nearly as strong as some of these other chemicals, surprisingly. But again, if things are already irritated, it's like pouring alcohol on a wound and it burns.
Yeah.
So it would burn.
Okay. To next caller, and again, champagne, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have one question. My question is, this is very upsetting to the family. I wonder if your guests could address that issue, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer, because it's very upsetting. Thank you.
I guess I'm not completely clear on what the question is.
I think, you know, everybody gets upset, and how do you reassure them not to be that way, upset? Because it looks very, very serious when it happens.
If so, oh, you mean if someone has reflux disease?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, what is that? How you know? So if I have this experience with, I guess I've had this experience with my family, because I happen to have reflux disease, and I know it concerns my mom a lot. And I say to her, well, you know, everybody's got some kind of problem, and this is mine, and I feel like I live with it, and so don't lose any sleep over it. I guess potentially it can be serious. I guess how do you know you're drawing the line between something that is just kind of a nuisance and something that potentially is really more serious than just being a nuisance?
I think most people will say that if you cannot easily control your reflux symptoms with over-the-counter medicines, or it's a recurrent problem where you're constantly having to retake medicines, especially the Prilosec, because it's a very strong medicine, a controlling acid, but it's a chronic problem and you have to continue to take it, you should have some type of evaluation. Reflux disease can certainly cause ulcers in the esophagus. Those ulcers heal and they cause strictures. What I think more people are concerned about is whether there's an association between reflux disease and esophageal cancers. Reflux is associated with Barrett's esophagus, which is considered a precancerous type change in the lining of the esophagus, which appears to increase the risk of esophageal cancer formation in a lifetime. It's not super high, but it certainly is there. And those patients it's recommended that they be screened with an endoscopy every few years at least to check for precancerous type changes. So I think the bottom line is, if it's a chronic recurring problem, if it's not been evaluated, it should. If things are looking good and you're in your 70s, then the chances of forming something like Barrett's is probably almost non-existent, extremely low. Whereas if you're in your 20s and you have severe reflux, you may want to have repeated endoscopies down the road to make sure that the Barrett's is not forming.
That, I'm sure that's one of the questions that's on people's minds. And you might say on the one hand, it seems like we have a lot of reflux and we have a lot of people on medication. And if in a lot of people that was going to proceed to to esophageal cancer, well, we'd have this epidemic of esophageal cancer,
exactly,
which we haven't seen. On the other hand, if it goes on, you're saying the longer that it goes on, the greater the chance that it might proceed to something worse.
Yeah, and it's probably when are we exposed to the acid, and there are a lot of patients that I see, they have severe reflux, they get ulcers in their esophagus. They're difficult to control even with the medicines, but they never form that Barrett's. That change in the lining never occurs, and we're not really sure why that occurs. And so it's just something that you have to look for. So probably people, they've got some inherent risk of that developing, but they're exposed to reflux early on. When? We don't know. Mm-hmm. And then it continues on as a chronic problem.
All right, let's go to, we have somebody here in Champaign on line one. Let's go there. Hello.
Hi, I'm calling from a payphone in a grocery store, so I hope you can hear through the background shopping cart. I just wanted to relate my experience. I have very, very severe GERD, acid reflux, and I basically had almost all the symptoms that your various callers had, the severe pain to the left of the sternum, which basically would put me on the floor, curled up. It was so bad. And after being tested by everyone, they were honored to do a Nissen funduplication on me. The problem was that I'm a heart patient, and nobody was willing to put me under the anesthesia until the GERD got so bad. They said, okay, we'll take that risk. But what finally happened is I didn't do the surgery because I ended up having a defibrillator put in, decided I'd had enough cutting. But what they finally put me on was Nexium twice a day and ranitidine or Zantac twice a day. And those two drugs are used independently of one another so that you don't have to worry that you take one or the other. And now I hear that they're using ranitidine not only, 150 milligrams twice a day, but they're starting to use them up to four times a day. And that actually has controlled all the symptoms. I do eat very spicy food. The only other thing I've done to control it is I've started to eat my dinner at lunchtime to make sure that I don't, because I have a tendency to go to sleep after I eat. That's not good. And by staying more mobile, it helps my the digestion go through. And I mean, it's a terrible illness. I've been coughing since I was 2 years old, and they took me off ACE inhibitors to see if that was causing it. No one ever found anything until they finally actually took pictures and saw that the acid was up in the middle of my esophagus. And I just want to emphasize what you just said. I asked my doctor about Barrett's syndrome, and he said the likelihood of your getting Barrett's syndrome is small. It's significant, but it's small. And two, Barrett's syndrome almost never goes into esophageal cancer. I mean, it can, but it hardly ever does. And so what we decided was to keep me on the Nexium and the ranitidine and to simply take pictures of me every year to see if I'm beginning to develop a Barrett's syndrome, because if I don't, then as long as the medicine works, it's fine. So people shouldn't give up, and you have to be careful because I've gone to doctors who are surgeons. Surgeons want to cut you. Basically, that's how they deal with it. I've gone to pulmonary people because I have a heart problem. Some people diagnosed it as part of my heart disease, and every specialist will give you a different diagnosis based upon their experience, and they'll look for your disease or your symptoms within their category of diseases. So it really takes a long, long time, and you have to just keep working with doctors. Hopefully you have an HMO where they can go from one to another. But don't take just one opinion and one prescription from a doctor, but keep checking things out and use every resource you can. And there's actually a pretty good chance that you can treat it, as you said, with over-the-counter and the hydrogen, the proton pump inhibitors as well. So I have to hang up because I'm running out of time on the cell phone.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll get the reaction from the doctor.
Actually, you bring up several good points. In all fairness, I'm a gastroenterologist, and so I don't do surgeries for reflux. But in all fairness to the surgeons, that's an alternative therapy. The Nissen fundoplication surgery is a surgery where the stomach is actually wrapped around the bottom of the esophagus, and it provides a barrier to acid coming up. Now, it's a barrier that doesn't relax anymore normally. It just it stays tight, and so your esophagus has to move normally in that situation. And it gets a little bit taken used to. You can't belch anymore. Many people cannot vomit, but it's quite effective. It was kind of used as a last resort because it was a huge surgery, a large incision around the side in order to get access to the esophagus and the stomach to do this. But in the last several years, since laparoscopic surgeries have been become so successful, most people are able to do this laparoscopically, and in the right hands, it's being done quite well and seems to be almost, if not as effective as the larger surgeries. So I think we're sending a lot more patients that direction earlier than before because it's just not as nearly as big a surgery as it was. Now, there are some endoscopic techniques that I will mention. they are very early in their use at this time. There are procedures that are done through the endoscope where we're trying, in essence, to do an endoscopic Nissen. We're trying to tighten that esophageal sphincter with either by sewing through the endoscope, which, as you can imagine, is a little bit tedious and lengthy, by actually putting clamps in that will keep that sphincter muscle tighter, or injecting medicines into the sphincter area or just below the sphincter area in order to increase those pressures. There have been several techniques now that have now been FDA approved. They're not being done in all centers, and their effectiveness is not really well known. We know that most of them are at least as effective as medicines are, and that's why FDA approved them. I think that the jury is still out on how effective they're going to be long term. They're fun to do. I've had a little bit of training in them, but I certainly wouldn't recommend them off the top of my head to anybody. The other comment I will make that the caller talked about was the use of Nexium in a medicine like ranitidine in combination. And there are different views on that, I believe, from going to several conferences on this. Nexium is a proton pump inhibitor, and it's actually, in essence, the same medicine as Prilosec. The company added an amino acid and put it out with a different name, but they also increased the dose of the medicine from 20 to 40 milligrams. And so it appeared like it was a little bit more effective, at least short term, for helping with reflux disease. Ranitidine is an H2 blocker. It's a histamine receptor blocker in the stomach. The proton pump inhibitors and antihistamine blockers or histamine blockers work differently. And so the theory is that, well, you hit two different areas of acid production. Some experts believe that if you're on a proton pump inhibitor, because of the way it works, don't even bother with the H2 blockers such as ranitidine. But I know there are different viewpoints on that, and some people say, no, use them together. They work differently, and you're probably blocking in two areas. The reason that the medicines like Nexium and Prilosec are so much more effective is that reflux control is very dependent on a constant pH control in the esophagus. Prilosec, Nexium, Acifex, Protonix, I think I've hit most of them, are all proton pump inhibitors, and they all work for almost a full 24 hours, and that's very important in controlling symptoms of reflux. The H2 blockers, such as ranitidine, Tagamet, Pepcid, don't give as long of control, and that's probably why they have not been as effective. So if you take them more often, certainly it would make sense that they would be more effective, but they just don't give that steady 24-hour control like the proton pump inhibitors, and that's why people have kind of geared away, because it's very difficult to take a medicine four times a day as opposed to once a day. Less often that you have to take it, the easier and the more compliant patients are going to be, me included.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have other callers. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist from Christie Clinic. We're talking about digestive health issues, and we'll keep on taking calls, again, as many people as we can in the time that remains. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go on to Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Oh, yes, hello. I'd like to discuss the dietary aspects, which you were briefly referring to before. I've had a sensitive stomach lining for many years. I took a lot of antibiotics when I was younger, and I just burned out my stomach lining, I guess. But I know that when I eat onions and spicy foods, acidic foods, I have burning in the stomach. And I'd like to share with you one thing that's helped me a lot, though, from a dietary aspect. I read once that drinking cabbage juice is good for, the stomach ulcers and the lining. But I've just learned that I've been helped a lot by just eating raw cabbage. You know, as one would eat lettuce, eat cabbage instead, or, along with it, put it in sandwiches, or, just eat it as a supplement in a salad or something like that. But I found that after eating that a few days, it really helps a lot. And it must be something in the cabbage that coats the lining of the stomach, and perhaps it would be even good for, the esophagus. But I just found it to be very helpful. After a few days, my stomach feels, the burning goes away. And if I eat that on a regular basis, it's very helpful to the lining. I'm wondering if you've had any other experience with that. I've heard some people say bananas are good for that, too. But I'm just wondering if you've had other people who've been benefited from this that you know of.
It's an interesting question. I don't know exactly what would be in cabbage juice, but I certainly could theorize why eating cabbage on a regular basis might help. Cabbage is a very high fiber source, and fiber also empties a little bit more slowly from your stomach. So it may actually be coating a little bit so that you're not as sensitive to other foods. Food sensitivities in the GI tract are probably a whole group of different problems, and so one thing's not going to work for everyone. I had someone that actually told me once that after trying all types of medicines, nothing helped, but when she drank lemon juice, so an acidic thing, it actually helped resolve all her stomach problems. So it's an interesting question, but I'm not sure what will be in cabbage.
Well, beside the cabbage, I remember when my father was alive, he had a terrible stomach problems, and you know, by accident, my mother ran into someone at the store who was buying Farina, you know, just baby Farina, you know, the things that you know, babies eat, and she asked the lady, "You have a baby?" You know, she says, "No, I buy this for my husband. That's the only thing that helps him with his stomach. He had terrible whatever they call that, pains." And she gave that to my father. Nothing else helped him, but as soon as he started eating that on a regular basis, you know, his stomach pains went away.
Well, you know, I think a lot of patients, rather than acid-related problems, have movement disorders along the lines of irritable bowel, but it can affect really anywhere in the GI tract. And when it affects the upper GI tract, it often presents as a burning type sensation, and that can really throw you off when you're trying to treat, because the first thing you think is use acid-controlling medicines. Or actually, if it's a motility problem, fiber supplements such as cabbage or even things like Metamucil or Citrucel, Benefiber, and Fibercon, there's lots of different fiber supplements with long-term use will actually help, because it's a movement disorder or a sensitivity to movement that causes the problem, and we know that fibers seem to decrease that.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, let's see. Go next to line number two. Caller is in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, I have a history of having acute and chronic gastritis from taking 81 milligram enteric-coated aspirin, and those have healed, but I have been taking 500 milligrams of vitamin C, and I wondered, I have not been taking that now because I'd cut out all other medications during the healing process. Would vitamin C be all right to take, or would that be irritating with someone with my history and perhaps also an irritable bowel syndrome?
Well, vitamin C I would expect to be fairly well tolerated. It's not, especially the tablets are not in acidic form, so I would expect that to be less irritating, and I wouldn't expect it to have a whole lot of effect on the irritable bowel. Everyone's a little bit different, certainly, but I think that would be fine.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And line number three here, caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
My understanding is that during surgery, tissue can be taken out and analyzed immediately for malignancy in just minutes. Would this be possible on a benign polyp in the colon so that they did not have to automatically remove half the colon in a hemicolectomy?
Usually people don't go on to surgery for polyps unless we have a diagnosis as to what type of polyp that is, and certainly a precancerous type polyp is what you're going to be taking the colon out for. So a real quick tissue diagnosis is not quite as useful at a time, for example, at a time of a colonoscopy, because you're going to be doing things in more of a sequential type pattern. And a lot of polyps can be removed actually through the endoscope so that people don't have to have surgery, unless certainly they become larger.
But so, if it's large and the colonoscopy has already been completed, but that doesn't seem like there is any malignancy, but they want to make sure. But isn't it possible to have this done at the time of surgery so that so much colon doesn't need to be removed?
I think it's less useful for a couple of reasons. Number one, if you're getting a superficial tissue sample, you don't know what's deeper, and that's the problem when we just take a biopsy of a polyp rather than the entire polyp, and sometimes we're surprised there ends up being a cancer actually deeper in the tissue. And then you're talking about two procedures, and if you're talking about surgery, two surgeries, which is not a great option. Mm-hmm. If you have a precancerous type polyp that's so large that a surgery is recommended and needs to be done, It's at the time of surgery, really, it's a moot point whether it's if there's cancer there or there's a big polyp that's precancerous there that has to come out. And surgeons try to take out the least amount of colon that's necessary in order to do the job. We can easily live without our colon. So taking out even half of the colon does not usually create too much problem for patients. Certainly, it may be a larger surgery, but even some of the surgeries for colon resections are starting to be done laparoscopically.
Mm-hmm.
So even nicer for patients as far as recovery time.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
All right. And I think we are just pretty much at the point where we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry. We have a couple of other people who might like to ask questions, but we're not going to be able to do that. Can we talk just real quick about testing for colon cancer? What's
Certainly.
The recommendations now?
There are three recommendations that are currently accepted by most general practice societies and the gastroenterology societies. And this has changed a little bit over the last few years. But the three choices are, number one, certainly stool card testing, which is testing for microscopic evidence of blood at age between 45 and 50 should be done on a yearly basis. If as long as those remain negative between age 45 and 50, the first sigmoidoscopy should be performed, the theory being that we thought at least that most polyps were being seen in the left side of the colon. If you have something there, then that would require a full colonoscopy to look at the remainder of the colon. But if it's negative, it's usually recommended that can be done then every 3 to 5 years as long as those stool cards remain negative. That's option one, and it's accepted. Second option is to do a sigmoidoscopy and barium enema every 5 years as long as the stool cards remain negative. Third option is to say, okay, we're just going to do a colonoscopy. And if that's negative, that can be done every 10 years as current recommendations.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for giving us your time. We appreciate
Certainly.
It.
Certainly.
Our guest, Dr. Claudia Nugent, she is a gastroenterologist from Christie Clinic. Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. In the next part of our show, we'll be talking with Stephen Strasser. He now teaches journalism at Rutgers University. For a number of years, worked for Newsweek magazine. He's the editor of a new book that brings together the staff reports of the 9/11 Commission. And we'll be talking about the commission and its report in the next part of Focus 580. First, though, we'll take a break. We'll have news at 11:01. And before that, an update on the commodity markets.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company, ADM. The nature of what's to come.
And with this update on the markets at 10:58, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. First of all, let's take a look at how things are going on the Chicago Board of Trade. The wheat futures for September currently down a quarter at 314.5. December wheat at 327.5 is unchanged. Corn for September, 220.25, up 1.75. December, 229, up 2.25. March 05, corn.